should they get give them to the earlier generations, that that would be a good thing to do. And that's, you see that in those debates in the paper today about, you know, the people in their 20s and 30s saying our parents are hanging on to all the money and we don't have any. And the third was identity, that do you accept you're old and accept your place in life and you retire and don't try to do all those groovy things and, you know, 50 is the new 30, as I explained before. So on those three things, they then did some, he did some research where they asked young people to, young people talk to an older person, and they got one group of older people to talk about their good life being, you know, I've retired, I've given some money to my children, and, you know, I know that I can't do all the things that, you know, younger people should do. And the other older people talked about that they were still at work, they saw themselves reinventing their careers, that they were still buying things and travelling and doing all of that, and that they had a kind of groovy identity. They were the kind of person who thinks, look, I'm 80, but really I'm, you know, as well as a 60-year-old. And of course, what they found was that younger people like the good life being the first, that you retire, you know your place, and you give things back. So also the good life is defined by different generations, and we are seeing more and more the question of, well, who defines what the good life is for people who are older? And it comes up in medical care. So should we give treatment to someone who's 90 who's got cancer, or should we not? And Bruce may touch on some of that. And then we have, what's the good life? So the first picture there where it says safe and secure is by a bank selling its retirement services. And so what it's selling is being safe and secure. And if you look at any retirement stuff, what it focuses on is money, and it focuses on being safe and secure. But the question is, is a good life taking risks when you're older? So is it actually, should you be allowed to take risks? Should you be allowed to do those sorts of things? So what is it society wants older people to do? And you will find a lot of society saying, well, they're just too old to do that, they shouldn't do it. So the question about risks or being safe and secure. So for each of you, which would be the good old age? A safe and secure one, or one where you're still growing, developing, and taking risks? And that last cartoon at the bottom is an old couple standing outside a cathedral, and he basically says, come on, kitten, we've never done it before in a chapel. So also the sexuality question, that you would all know that what people think about older people and sexuality is that it doesn't happen. Older people don't have sex. The good life doesn't include sex when you're an older person. For other generations, they hate thinking about it. So when Virgin did a series of ads where it showed older people in states of undress and having a good time, there was many complaints that shouldn't have actually been shown. So the good life depends, again, where I started, with what lens you're using. Now, this is a quote, in old age we should wish still to have passions strong enough to prevent us turning in upon ourselves. One's life has value so long as the attributes value to the life of others by means of love, friendship, indignation, and compassion. And that was written about 50 years ago, I think, maybe a bit longer. So where I started with that lens of how do we view the good life, and how are we going to deal with some of the conflicts that come up in our society about who defines what the good life is. Because we have collective definitions of the good life, and we have personal definitions of the good life, and that dialectic is always there being debated about what you think the good life is and what the community thinks the good life is. To have a good life, does that also mean, segueing into Bruce's presentation, does having a good life also mean having a good death? So as I said earlier, everyone hopes that they'll die in their sleep overnight, but for most of us that isn't what will happen. So how do we manage a good death as well? So how, and in our society, we don't talk about death, generally speaking. So maybe a good life should also include having a good death. So there are five key messages that come out of the research about aging and how to stay well, which I want to leave you with, is the first is if you want to stay active and engaged in the world, you've got to be interesting and you've got to be interested in the world. So if you want to have a good life in old age, what we know is go and do something that challenges your brain. So the two things that people talk about are learning another language or a musical instrument. That our brain is now plastic, well into our 90s. When I went to university in the 70s, in Psychology 1, I was taught that we were born with a certain number of brain cells and that those brain cells declined over time and we just got less and less. We now know that that's completely false. In fact, the brain is an amazing muscle that can actually learn new skills. We need to stay connected with people. That's very important now, staying connected as an older person. If you don't use it, you'll lose it. So you all know the messages for the good life are you need to have a good diet, good exercise and social connections. And that's not just someone making that up, that's actually based on evidence. Those are the three things we know. But the challenge for most of us as humans is, well, we're not always good at doing those three things, so how do we do that? Having purpose in your life, and that you get to choose your attitude about what the good life is. So I've certainly met people who, for them, almost the good life is when they're 50, defining themselves as old, that they've accepted that they're old. Whereas when I first saw the first ad that said I could get cheaper insurance because I turned 50, I remember feeling offended, thinking, what? They think I'm old and now I can. But other people would see that, well, that's great. That's what the good life is. You know, I've worked all my life and now I'm 50 and I should get some of those benefits. So partly what I'd leave you with is the good life is partly how you define it, but we should never forget that we're also defined by the social constructions in which we live. Thank you.
Bruce.
Thank you, and greetings to you all. I guess I'm really picking up the question which has already been raised by Ralph, and that is, does a good life get completed with a good death, and if so, what might that mean? So I suppose in some ways what I'm doing really is raising some questions about it, but I am beginning with the assumption, a fairly well evidence-based assumption, that all of us die. There are people now who tend to dispute the at least in some of the gerontology stuff, we dispute whether we actually need to. I don't think there's any much evidence to say that that death is dispensable. The reality is, to use the dreaded palliative care phrase, that life is a sexually transmitted condition with 100% mortality. Now, in terms of why at least in a political level, starting to have some of these discussions, it's picked up in these next three slides. One of them is that for more than a century, the death rate in Australia has been declining. Last year, it started to rise again as the baby boomers began to reach what did we reach? What did you reach? I'm older than the baby boomer.
That's right.
It's hitting the 70 sort of territory, and so the death rate will increase, and in actual fact, in terms of the absolute numbers of deaths in Australia in the next 20 years is going to double. One of the issues is that our present ways of dealing with death and dying in our present services aren't going to cope. They're barely coping at the present moment. Part of the reason for that is too that the pattern of dying has changed radically over the last century, and now we now have this compression in old age, that while a century ago death occurred really at various times of the life cycle, now it's largely at the end of life. So that most of us die in our 70s and 80s, and while there have been some rather outlandish comments made about the way in which our lifespan is increasing, in actual fact the lifespan isn't increasing. As Ralph pointed out, life expectancy at birth has increased by 30 years or whatever in the last century. Life expectancy at the age of 85 has increased by 1 year in the century. Okay. so that we're all hitting up against this well-established barrier. It's just that many more of us are getting there. And the other working factor, I suppose, is that while lifespan, or while the years we live is increasing, so too are the years of living with disability. And that can be mild disability through to severe disability. I'm not entirely sure what always corresponds to disability. I've got a crooked knee, I suppose, which sort of slows me down a little bit. Is that a disability? Maybe it is. I guess in the natural fact the arthritis accelerates, it can become severe. But to sum it up in terms of end-of-life stuff, the Grattan Institute report of Hal Sverrison and Stephen Duckett, both for their sins, previous deans of the Faculty of Science at of Health Sciences at La Trobe, make that comment: over the next 25 years, double the number of people dying. There's plenty of evidence that people want to die a better death, whatever that might be, and that there's a lot of evidence that people at least say they want to die at home, but the majority of us don't make it under the present circumstances. And in actual fact, there are some pretty hefty costs associated with that institutional dying. And alongside that is that we're at the present moment, we're investing more and more money into a system which can actually deliver less and less of what we're actually asking for. So it's back to that Albert Einstein quote, is it not, that the definition of insanity is keeping on doing what has been demonstrated already not to work. And that's pretty much the scenario in which a lot of our health system is currently operating. But in terms of having discussions about it, about planning, Ralph's already indicated the way at the individual level, planning is not incredibly evident. At the policy level, planning is not exactly evident either. Here's the World Health Organization Age-Friendly Communities document, which is the age-friendly city, the age-friendly community, is a program being rolled out globally, and lots of Victorian municipalities have signed up for age-friendly cities. But death is mentioned once, that somebody's spouse may have died. Dying is not mentioned at all. And palliative care turns up in a list of services. And in actual fact, if you go through most of our documentation around aging, you will not find dying turning up. We have no policy, until the last few months, in Victoria anyhow, no policy about dying. So you age apparently indefinitely and successfully and positively, and then somehow you disappear, but the process by which you disappear is unarticulated and not dealt with in policy at all. Okay. This is in contrast, I guess, to traditional understandings, at least of a good death, and which was, and here actually is where the link is, that in traditional society it was always understood, and as I guess that's religious society, that the way that you live a good life is to reflect upon your mortality. That you learn how to live a good life by reflecting upon the fact that you will die, and hence you make good decisions about. But that level of reflection has largely disappeared, I suppose, from our practices. So traditionally in Western society, we inherit the idea of a good death essentially as being dying in the company of friends and family, having time to finish your unfinished business, dying at home, being able to say goodbyes, to finish off the business, to be able to say some things that matter to the people that matter to you. And so it's a sort of a semi-public event, the good death. You're surrounded by people who listen to you and who care about you and are actually eager to hear what your last words are. That puts a bit of pressure on you as well, you know, to get a good set of last words together and then just stuff it up and use them up and then recover. I mean, all sorts of embarrassments can occur around it. But still, the idea is there, that it is a farewell, and I guess behind it is the idea that dying is a gateway to a new and hopefully better life. But with the rise of science and industrialization, and particularly with the rise of events like the First World War, things started to change. The First War was what put the kibosh on the rituals by which we used to handle death, dying and grief. Because now, in this period of time, 8 million men died in 4 years, and the bodies were not brought home. There were no ways of the rituals of remembrance disappeared. We ended up with statues in the main streets and the lists of all the boys from the neighbourhood who didn't make it. That's, you know, which you see in every Australian country town now. And so we lost our rituals, and we were left with a language of heroic death, that these wonderful young men laid down their lives for us, and so our good life today is as a consequence of their sacrifice. And that story continues to resonate. But there's another story back then that we don't ever talk about, and that is that in the 2 years after the First World War, estimates vary, between 50 and 100 million people died in 2 years from the Spanish flu. Don't talk about it. Haven't got a language to talk about it. And yet this is everyday dying. This is the way most of us die. And we don't have a language. And in many ways, I guess, in modernity became silent about death and dying until we got these two powerful ladies turning up in the 70s on your left, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, mad as a cut snake, but still a lady who managed to get a whole global dialogue going around her stages of dying idea, which actually hasn't got much to do with dying at all, but it's, you know, it got a conversation going. And on the right, the deceptively benign, grandmotherly Dame Cicely Saunders, a fearsome woman in many respects, who was, she was a nurse who did her back and became a social worker and got a vision for terminal care and decided she had to become a medical practitioner to make it happen, and wasn't averse to acting as Anglican chaplain as well. So she was a one-woman, multidisciplinary team, and she was the founder of the hospice movement, which became palliative care. But what it means with this sort of history behind us is that I think we have, I would suggest, at least this number of ideas about good death kicking around today. One of them is the traditional. For some people, the good death is still largely the traditional religious death. Mind you, it's largely Buddhist now rather than Christian, because Christianity is so unimaginative about dying. It's really quite deadly in some respects. But Buddhism gives you some wonderful technologies, and a lot of people have taken that on board because it gives you a way of transitioning in and out of the whole event, and it's essentially religious ritual shaping of the event. The other one, as Ralph's already reminded us, is the good death is when you can't get in your sleep. But yesterday you were alive, the day you're dead, and you didn't have to go through the whole process of dying and all that bother, so it's nice and neat and, well, presumably it's good news for you. I'm not quite so sure about the those left behind. There's also quite a rhetoric, it comes out of Anzac, I suppose, about the heroic good death. She battled heroically against her cancer until the end, and it's largely mixed up with medical practice, but the idea is that the heroic dyer is a person who does absolutely everything, leaves no stone unturned, accepts every form of treatment, and so in a sense they've done everything that they possibly could to stay with their family and their friends, and then somehow it just wasn't enough. Palliative care is another model of the good death, and that's the idea where, I guess in a sense, you embrace it, or you understand dying in some traditional senses as a journey into a known or unknown future. And the other one, which is a fair amount of press around at the present moment, is physician-assisted dying. And that's yet the idea of a good death, that you can stay in control all the way, including at the end. Now, no doubt you could probably add a few more to the list as well, but that's sort of some of the major types that are kicking around, and that's where a lot of the debates continue to run. But I guess I'd suggest that those debates are still framed largely within the healthcare system. That one of the dilemmas I would suggest for a lot of our discussions are the aging and dying continue to be seen as healthcare concerns. And I'd add to that, one of the problems is that our healthcare systems have actually known nothing about health, really. They're about illness and disability. And health is, you know, is always a negative or a passive idea within it. So the dilemma in that sense is that health services tend to see us as largely needy people who may have one or two things going for us, whereas most of us see ourselves most of the time as actually being involved in living and occasionally needing a bit of a chippy along to keep it going. Okay. Further, when it comes to end of life, we need to remember that most of us do most of our declining, dying, living with illness in our ordinary everyday lives. We actually have very little contact with healthcare through most of our dying. Our dying, in that sense, the end of our lives, is essentially a social event in which we need support from family and friends, where we need to be able to maintain our identity as much as possible, reflect upon our lives, experience gratitude for that, whatever it might be, you know, that sort of stuff. And even to illustrate in palliative care, if you're in a community-based palliative care service in Victoria, your average length of stay in that service is 119 days, during which time you get 30 interventions, which if you're really lucky might add up to 24 hours, it actually doesn't. So the question is, who looks after you the other 118 days? Well, it's family, it's friends, it's the dog, it's the neighbours. And if you really wanted to improve end-of-life care, you'd look at investing in those people, the 118 days, not necessarily trying to put some bells and whistles on the healthcare expertise, which is so radically rationed within the system. So, promoting health at the end of life, one of them is, as I think Ralph's already alluded to, why not think about dying as an occupation which we engage in? And the small print there says that we prepare for a birth, why not for a death? As long as we realise the same caveats that your birth plan is about as reliable as your death plan. And so it's nice to have it's sort of aspirational in a sense, which is one of the reasons why I'm not incredibly impressed by a lot of the advanced care planning rhetoric, because it is at best aspirational. And at the present moment, with the way our services are, a lot of the choices can't be delivered. So you need to change your structures as well for planning to become a little bit more realistic. Again, as Ralph's indicated, ultimately, planning means facing up to, looking at, engaging with the mastery of decay. There's George Valant, who's a... What's George? He's almost 90, isn't he? So he's still a fairly active player in the scene. As he says, to achieve positive aging at the end of life necessitates an almost Buddhist acceptance. In that sense, we need to bring to the end of our lives resources which we have developed through our lives. And Valant goes on to talk about what he sees as resilience in old age. They mirror, in slightly more words, precisely the things that Ralph ended up with. Caring about having been open to possibility. Being able to have a reasonably wry and self-deprecating sense of humour about some of the stuff that happens to us as old people. And yet being hopeful in some way. Being sustained by memory of past accomplishments and yet being able to let go. It's actually a very ambivalent way of living. I mean, I recognise it in myself because I'm almost at the end of a young old phase. I'm 72. So for me, there is that sort of sense now of I can plan, but I also have reservations. It's the old-fashioned, it was the old-fashioned religious phrase, Deo Voluntatis, God willing, that you add to everything. I'll go to the conference in Ottawa in September, God willing, because who knows what's going to happen in the next 6 months. So you plan and yet you hold loosely. So you continue to live but recognise that you're also preparing to die. And those two things go together and have to stay together. And one of the dilemmas I would say within healthcare is that they're seen as opposites. But they actually are essentially integrated. You have to attend to both in order to be hopeful, I think. So how can we begin or continue to think about dying as part of our development? How can we understand healthy aging as including some ideas about healthy dying? How can it be a civic conversation, not just a healthcare conversation? How can we do it in terms of the assets-based, rather than looking at dying and aging as essentially a problem-based thing, as the Productivity Commission tends to? What are the actual assets involved in aging and having an aging component to our conversation? It raises some important conversations that we need to have. Dan Callahan's a medical ethicist. He wrote this in his 80s, so it's worth, in that sense, it's worth listening to. This is not a young person's idea about what should be going on. But yeah, it's the obligation of a good society to help the young become old, but not help old people become indefinitely older. Okay. Young should support the old should give, you know, respect the young. Rationing of limited health resources is inevitable, and it should be an open, transparent, civic-based activity rather than a covert activity within healthcare, which is what's already happening within our system. So how do we start to develop, these are all questions, how do we start to develop policies and programs that help us learn what it's actually like to grow old, pay attention to the settings in which people age and die, and recognise that essential ambivalence or ambiguity or duality that I've talked about, you know, that preparing to die doesn't mean giving up on living. Well, Wechi is the new Victorian end-of-life care framework actually invites us to do some thinking around that stuff at the present moment. I'm not entirely sure I put this into the list. Our unit's about to start to do some work with the Municipal Association of Victoria to start to colonise a statewide positive ageing network to talk about dying as well as living. And compassionate communities is something I'd make a comment to. I've just come back from a conference in Sydney around the idea of compassionate communities, which is a conversation that's beginning and end of life, but it's asking the question about how do you build communities which provide an active and public place, a way of participating for people who are chronically ill, who are ageing, who are dying, who are grieving? So it's a healthy settings approach, but asking that question around end-of-life care. As for the Victorian stuff, I've probably gone over time, but let me finish with this. The Parliamentary Inquiry on End-of-Life Choices reported a few months ago, and they identified, for better or for worse, what they saw as 12 core values for end-of-life care, which are listed there. They also brought about three sections of recommendations. There are 49 recommendations, of which we've only really heard about one in the press. And that's the last of them, legalising assisted dying. But in reality, there's a whole swag of resolutions about trying to build community capacity beyond the health sector for end-of-life care, and also getting a more robust way of actually recognising, giving statutory recognition to people's advanced care or end-of-life wishes. And then, of course, there's the legalising assisted dying. And from that, or alongside that, is Victoria's End of Life and Palliative Care Framework, which identifies a series of priorities like this. I think I'm right in saying that the statutory recognition of end of life care plans and treatment wishes comes up in a couple of months' time within State Parliament. The assisted dying legislation is likely to be floated for ongoing community consultation in May or June, and there will be a 2-year implementation and discussion period before it actually comes into a form of implementation. But in that sense, we are at an interesting time in which we actually have a chance now for more community input into this about how actually do we wish to live our dying and to end our lives, and how do we wish those services to respond to what we actually want rather than what the professionals think we might need. I think that's probably where I start to, yes, at the end.
Gentlemen, thank you.
before we throw over to the audience, both of you made reference to the intergenerational component of this. And I'm conscious that the most prolific users of the podcast of these sessions are school kids, secondary school kids. So I'm wondering, what would either or both of you say to a bunch of secondary school kids about this in their own lives and in the lives of the people with whom they interact?
I actually do this in teaching, so they're a bit older than university students, but I often ask them in the first lecture when I talk about ageing, we brainstorm all the words that people have about older people. And the board is usually, and these are social work students, so they're usually negative. You know, it's decrepitude, you know, getting old, losing your memory, cranky. And then I ask them to think about their grandparents when they were little kids. What words would they use then? And then they say, well, love, cuddles, story time, going on holidays with grandma and grandpa. So it's also reminding people that you have to think about aging through a number of lenses, which is really my point, is that when all of you in this audience remember your grandparents, for most of us, most of our grandparents, you know, are a positive influence. But many of us then watch them die, and that's what tends to stay in our mind rather than some of the positive things. And the dying part and the being disabled is a very small part of the human lifespan, but it somehow captures our imagination, I guess because we all fear it in some ways. So I would get them to think about their grandparents and what they get from them.
Beautiful.
Sharon Kaufman did a study which she called The Ageless Self. It was she called it that because it was an unexpected finding. She interviewed a lot of old people, and one of the things that she discovered coming through was the fact that most of them, at some stage, referred to the fact that, I know I'm old, but I don't feel old inside. And what she discovered was that most of them, most of us, have a sense of ourselves as, you know, maybe in our 30s. That's the way we feel about ourselves. And, you know, most of us who are aging, you know, I used to walk through Myers, you know, those pretty perfume counters. You catch a glimpse of this strange wrinkled figure approaching you, and it looks vague and familiar, and suddenly realise it's yourself in one of those damn mirrors. But I think that there is a sense in which within all old people there is a 30-year-old. And I basically encourage my health science students to say, look for that person. Get in behind the facade, get in behind the grumpiness, get in behind all the other habituated responses, and find out that lively, ongoing person inside.
And certainly just to add to that, one of the things I get people to do is, particularly students, is when they are thinking about someone 85, I ask them to think back to when that person was born. And then I ask to think about all of the things that have happened in that person's life. And when I was much younger, teacher, thinking about people who lived through World War One, the Depression, World War Two, the changes they've seen, that old people have lived a life and how you see that. And I do remember one older woman when I was doing some research said to me, Ralph, will you stop seeing women as mothers? Because I'm 80 and I was a mother for 20 years and I did a really good job. But for the other 60 years, I was doing something else. So that also that gender thing about how we think about people who live long lives.
Yes.
We might turn the recording off there and invite the audience to join us. We've got some time, so please.